Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. President Trump suggests he mentioned former Vice President Joe Biden in telephone call with the Ukrainian president. A whistleblower complaint about President Trump made by an intelligence official is believed to center on the Ukraine setting off a struggle between Congress and the executive branch. The complaint involved communications with a former leader and a quote-unquote promise that President Trump allegedly made, which was so alarming that a U.S. intelligence official who had worked at the White House went to the Inspector General of the intelligence community, according to former officials. Now, President Trump appeared to confirm yesterday that he mentioned former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter in a telephone call with the leader of Ukraine as some senior Democrats revived talk of impeachment hearings over revelations that Trump has asked a foreign government to investigate one of his potential 2020 opponents. What does this mean for the president going forward, and does this put the Democrats in a precarious position? For insight, we turn to my first guest. He's the co-host of Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan, heard here every morning. He is our own Lee Stranahan. Lee, as always, welcome back.
Hey, Dr. Leon, great to be on. Thank you.
So the story breaks with a whistleblower complaint about President Trump trying to leverage U.S. aid to the Ukraine to get Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to give him dirt on Joe Biden. Now, Trump and his surrogates are raising the specter of impropriety on the part of Biden, whose younger son, Hunter, was on the board of a Ukrainian gas company that Trump pushed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate. And this is according to those familiar with the matter.
Okay, so that's according to people spinning the matter. Let me tell you what's actually
going
on here.
There we go.
Because this, okay, so let's back time this. Today in New York, Donald Trump was at the UN. Some people are talking about the climate. He's talking about religion. Okay, leave that aside.
Let us pray.
He's also going to be meeting with world leaders who are also at the UN today, one of whom is Zelensky. And I think this whole story, which started about a week ago, was designed basically to try to gaslight people on what's actually going on in this Ukraine story. And because they're very, I think a lot of people in the intelligence community and in the deep state, and including in Trump's administration. Remember, my belief is that Trump has real disloyal. Well, I'll put it like this. I don't think that's a belief. He's proven to have people who are very disloyal to him over and over and over again, from Scaramucci to Omarosa, to people who are in his administration who come out and start attacking him. Now, wait a minute,
Lee. He starts with clowns to begin with. Whether it's Omarosa, whether it's Scaramucci, these aren't the best and the brightest or the sharpest knives in the drawer. And then you've got a president that will say anything to anybody at any moment and then retract what he said, only then to go back to what he said, only then to retract what he said. So we can't just paint these people as disloyal.
Well, I'm not, but I'm just saying that over and over again, he's had people who he would say, he would think, when I say that there's people who do not have his best interest at heart who are surrounding him.
He would say that.
He would say that,
okay.
And I think it's clearly
that
true.
I'll agree with.
And I would say Mike Pompeo, for instance, is one of those people. I would say Bolton clearly was one of those people who have a very different foreign policy objective than Trump ran on. And you can see it's caused with Bolton, he had to let go of him. Now, what's happening here is, first off, let's get the facts straight. Not that you're screwing it up, Dr. Leon, but no, I'm serious. Here's the reality.
Okay.
Joe Biden has been under investigation for years and his son was under investigation, not under Zelensky, but under the previous president, Petro Poroshenko.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that? Let's go back to the bigger crime
right
here. I don't think Trump is going far enough with Biden. In fact, I think the whole point is to make him not go far enough.
Which is why I asked in the opening the question, does this put the Democrats in a precarious position?
It does, but right now they got the wind at their back and the media going along with it. They're making this about Trump pressuring a leader, a world leader, in a way that they say is inappropriate, which is not inappropriate at all for reasons I'll talk about in a second. And then they're saying, and we got to impeach. You can see that that's driving up right now. It's all BS. So here's the reality. The Washington Post and the New York Times have previously reported, this goes back to 2017, about Biden's problems, they say, with his son. Now, his son, who clearly has addiction issues, and I say that because he was held hostage in L.A. by a guy who's trying to buy crack from, something that's never happened to me, but okay. And I'm not even knocking it, but I'm saying his son has addiction issues. And then he got this incredibly well-paying job.
$50,000 a month?
Something like that, yes. Pretty good. That's pretty good pay.
That's good money.
So then they were investigating that. Then we have audio of Joe Biden a couple of years ago at the Council on Foreign Relations admitting to strong-arming Poroshenko and saying, I'm getting on a plane in 6 hours. If you want the $1 billion you were promised, you need to fire the prosecutor who was looking in to Hunter Biden.
You're a little kind on that. He was more or less bragging about it.
He was absolutely bragging about it, yes. No, he was absolutely bragging about it. And it's on audio. And I've seen a lot of people, even in the conservative media, Dr. Leon, who are saying, well, it's alleged. Or he allegedly.
No, he said it.
You're right. He absolutely said it.
I heard it.
And he was proud of it.
Yes,
He was very proud of it.
I'm a gangster, too.
And he said, you have 6 hours. Now, imagine if Trump had said to Zelensky, you better investigate this. You got 6 hours. Every Democrat head would be exploding. But really, really, let's talk about the predicate to that situation, which is Joe Biden would not have been in a place where he could have even made that request had the United States not overthrown a democratically elected government in Ukraine in 2014. Yanukovych, like him or not, was elected, and they did not have another election to replace him. In fact, when they voted to impeach him, a lot of people don't know this. After Yanukovych was thrown out on the Maidan Revolution, which was backed by the Obama administration under Kerry and was set up under Clinton, when Yanukovych fled, they then took a vote to impeach him, and it failed. It failed. It actually did not pass. So Yanukovych was democratically elected. Again, I think if he lost in the election, I don't think Russia would have cared, really. Russia was not a big fan of Yanukovych. And Yanukovych, by the way, when he was being consulted with on Manafort, it's interesting. A lot of people get this wrong, but they had to correct this in the trial. You know, Paul Manafort was urging Yanukovych to go with Europe, not with Russia. He specifically said, I don't think you should be with Russia anymore. Go with Europe. So a lot of what's happened here is the U.S. overthrew that democratically elected government. And nobody in this country knows or cares much about that. There's a great film called Ukraine on Fire, which goes into detail about this. And so then what happened was, then you had the Crimea situation, which is there was a threat of ethnic cleansing in Crimea. They were saying, we're going to drive from Kiev and kill people.
And the threat of ethnic cleansing was sponsored or started by who?
That was sponsored by the people who overthrew Yanukovych, which includes a very sort of, when I say right-wing, European right-wing, which means fascist. These are neo-Nazi groups that literally Sieg Heil and, I mean, stuff like that. You can find it. If you look up Svoboda, which is S-V-O-B-O-D-A, Svoboda, John McCain, you'll find a picture of John McCain next to a dude and he's Sieg Heiling and stuff. But that's right sector. Those are the other ones. So these far right groups, which included Nazi collaborators, people, you know, Bandera, the guy they worship, was a Nazi collaborator at one point, Lebed. We really helped some bad people over there. And the effect on the people of Ukraine was devastating. Became the poorest country in Europe. Poroshenko, who we put in place, had the lowest approval rating of any leader in the world, 6%. At one point, right before he lost the election to Zelensky. So Biden's being investigated. And furthermore, the thing everyone's hiding is that the Democrats were colluding with the government of Ukraine in the 2016 election. And we've covered that extensively in Fault Lines. This is originally reported by Ken Vogel over at Politico Anybody can find it. Efforts to Sabotage Trump Campaign Backfire is the name of the article. And it talks about this DNC operative named Alexander Chalupa, who was specifically working with the Ukrainian government, including Poroshenko knew about it. So now you've got a situation where you had DNC, Democrat interference in the election, colluding with a foreign government, exactly the thing that they accused Trump of with Russia. But they don't have any proof, whereas we know who did it. And I've interviewed whistleblowers and everything else. So what they're trying to do here, the precarious situation, is they want to flip the script on Biden and make it seem like Trump's the one colluding with Ukraine. Nope. Trump talked to Zelensky about the Biden situation, where Biden, again, he had bragged about it. Now, here's what's interesting to me, Dr. Leon. Where are the other? Don't forget, Joe Biden is not the nominee, right? So if he were the nominee, I would understand a certain amount of circle the wagons with the Democrats. I get that. I'm realistic, but he's not the nominee.
But he is the presumed. And he is the presumed nominee because he is the favorite of establishment Democrats, and establishment Democrats believe that he is next in line and they are trying to follow pecking order.
But
right?
Yes, but okay. If Bernie Sanders wanted to go for the kill shot right now on Biden, the way to do it would be to look at the situation and go, you know, Joe Biden himself, blah, 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 and play the audio and say, here's the New York Times article from 2017. Here's the Washington Post article.
Elizabeth Warren would be the one to make the move now since she's ascending in polls.
I agree, but here's what I think. She would never do that.
And that's not her game.
That's not her game. She is 100% establishment. Right. She wants to show she's going to play along. But I agree with you. But here's the thing. Anybody, Julian Castro, for instance, he went after Biden on his memory.
But Castro is in the tier. He lives in the land of broken toys.
Yeah, no, right.
If it got him 5 more points in the polls, he's still at the bottom.
But I'm saying, I think it's possible. It's possible one of the Democrats will wise up on this and realize this is a real issue.
You didn't mention Kamala Harris in that group.
Well, I didn't.
That's a play that she could make and I think benefit more than any of the bottom tier people.
Okay, so it could. Let me tell you.
As a prosecutor, she comes across now very authoritative, not authoritarian,
yes.
Authoritative, and she lays it out as a prosecutor and makes it a hard issue to debate.
Let me tell you why I don't think she would do that.
Because she's establishment too.
Well, and because if Biden gets the nomination, he's already made it very clear. He's said nice stuff about Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes a lot of sense as a woman of color to balance the ticket when Joe Biden is.
Because she's Barack Obama in drag.
Right. Sure.
When you listen to her platform, when you listen to her delivery, when you look at her background, she's the female version of Barack Obama.
Yeah. No, I can see that. Yeah. So I think this could backfire in the Democrats. Now, right now, the media and the Trump administration actually are helping Biden right now. They're completely covering for Biden. But this situation is very dangerous because so much of the story is actually established. It's not hard to figure out that Alexander Chalupa, she's admitted it. There's a WikiLeaks email where she was coordinating on this Ukraine stuff. And I think if people start waking up a little bit, now the problem is, and again, this is going to be hard for people to believe on the left, but Donald Trump's worst enemy in the media is actually Fox News. And the reason why is because it's the only network he listens to. And therefore, when they lie to him, and they are lying to him, people like John Solomon, who's on Hannity all the time, they are doing a limited hangout on this. They're giving him just enough information to go, hey, the big problem is Hunter Biden. But you know what? Nobody is saying, hey, well, what about that Ukraine coup? Maybe we shouldn't have done that, because they've learned. By the way, I
they don't want to bring the Ukraine coup, because that then, to any logically thinking person, brings in the Venezuela conversation.
Yeah, it brings in
in Syria
and Saudi Arabia or whatever. I mean, everything.
But
yeah.
I say it brings in Venezuela because that is Donald Trump exercising U.S. foreign policy. It didn't start with him, but he is the one basically to be fanning these flames. And
I'll tell you what else it brings up is Hong Kong, because Hong Kong right now is basically a Ukraine coup in motion. And in fact, it's so explicit over there that they showed that film I mentioned before. No, they didn't. Forgive me. There's two films. Ukraine on Fire is a great film. They didn't show that one. They showed this other Winter Fire or whatever it's called about Ukraine. They showed that film in Hong Kong. And you had Hong Kongese saying, crying, going, I hope this works out the same way for us that it did for Ukraine. Well, you know what? Go talk to people in Ukraine.
Be careful what you pray for.
You don't really want that outcome, but that's what they're talking about.
Okay, so let's put a bow around this. We've got about 3 minutes. Did Donald Trump, as far as you know, talk to Zelensky about getting dirt on Joe Biden? Did Donald Trump use or try to use aid as leverage for a quid pro quo? And if so, is the basis of that reporting accurate?
No, because the dirt part is that, was there an open investigation into Joe Biden that Joe Biden got shut down? Yes, there was. There into Hunter Biden. There was an open investigation into Burisma, which is the company in question here. There was an open investigation into that, which according to Joe Biden, according to that audio, Joe Biden got that shut down.
Okay.
Right? Now, Trump asking the new leader, what's going on with this? Rudy Giuliani was just over there, which as far as I know is what he did. Completely reasonable.
But there's no validity to his withholding U.S. aid as leverage to try to get Zelensky to do that.
You mean like Joe Biden said?
No, Lee. That's a yes or no. We're not. Just because you did it, I can do it.
Answer that
question.
Well, the answer is, I know 100% Joe Biden did it because he admitted it.
That's not my question, Lee.
I understand. But
then answer my question.
But I know 100%. What I don't know is the content of the call between Zelensky and Trump. But what I'm saying is, if you're going to say somehow that tying it into aid, let's say, is wrong for a U.S. leader to do,
it's wrong for Joe Biden to do. There's no question about that.
And I don't think that there is any connection between that. I think Trump probably asked, my guess is Trump asked him about it.
But there's been some reporting that it's not only one call, there was some reporting that there were maybe 7 or 8 conversations.
I believe it's entirely possible that it could have come up over 7 conversations, but still had nothing to do with the quid pro quo. It still had nothing to do with that. But again, I got to say, Joe Biden, let me be really clear on this. Joe Biden is a war criminal. People died in the Ukraine situation, and he did it for personal profit and period. Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, they are war criminals. They overthrew a democratically elected government.
They did that in Libya.
Lied to the American people absolutely about it. And it's, again, this is part of what's going on. So to me, the Biden situation, there's not even a question of like Trump doing something because Don Jr. benefits or anything like that. The situation with Hunter Biden, the Post and the Times, a couple of years ago, they said, well, gee, this is a real problem. Now it's just trying to be impeachment fodder. But, you know, you pointed it out, Dr. Leon, the issue here is they got to be careful what they wish for, because this Ukraine thing is a minefield for Democrats. And I can see already people like Mark Meadows, the Republican from the Freedom Caucus, he's already mentioning Alexander Chalupa, which I've never seen. I've seen very rare. Now, a guy like Nunez, he's not real helpful. So we'll see. If the Republicans play this right, it could be a huge benefit, but I'm not hopeful about that. So,
Lee Stranahan, as always, man, thank you for your analysis. Thank you for coming in and providing this insight. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
You bet.
All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The General Motors strike enters the second week with no clear end in sight. The strike against GM by over 49,000 United Auto Workers entered its second week today, with progress reported in negotiations but no clear end in sight. Bargainers met all weekend and returned to talks today as the strike has entered its eighth day. This is going on longer than I think many anticipated. And let's get some insight into what's going on and why we turn to my next guest. She covers the auto industry for Labor Notes. She is Ms. Jane Slaughter. Jane, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So before we get to where we are, let's start to how we got here. What's at the basis of the UAW striking with 49,000 United Auto Workers?
The basis is that GM has been immensely profitable since the government and we taxpayers rescued it from bankruptcy back in 2009. In the last 3 years alone, they've made $35 billion worth of profits and have not paid federal income tax, and they pay their chief executive officer, Mary Barra. She got $22 million last year, and they have not been sharing that with the workers. On the contrary, they have been demanding more and more. So in their last contract in 2015, they got the right to increase temporary workers. Those workers work for half the pay of a regular worker, and they're not temporary at all. They work there for years and years and years. They just are paid less and have none of the other rights or benefits that the regular workers have. So people in the plants are very upset about this. They aren't happy to have two workers working next to each other doing the exact same job, and one is paid twice as much. And they feel that they made a lot of sacrifices back when GM was in bankruptcy. In fact, this is a whole different category, but one of the sacrifices they took was that newly hired workers would only be paid half pay. They're doing better now, but they're still not up to where the older workers are. So there's a large number of, they call them tiers in the factory, tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four, people making all sorts of different wages. And they're pretty fed up with that and would like to rectify it.
$35 billion in profit. You didn't say revenue. You said profit.
That's correct.
I wanted to stress that because people need to understand that's a heck of a lot of money. Is there any idea how much the demands of the United Auto Workers would cost General Motors? Because there may be some listening to say, oh, well, if the United Auto Workers demands are going to cost General Motors $40 billion, then it makes perfect sense for General Motors to hold the line because now they're going back into bankruptcy. So is there any idea of how much the demands that the auto workers are making on General Motors would actually cost General Motors?
No, I'm sorry, there's not. I'm sure that the people at the table have been costing out their proposals, but they are playing those cards very close to their vest, and they aren't telling us exactly what their proposals are. They're not telling the members exactly what their proposals are. But I can guarantee you that it would be a whole lot less than $35 billion or a third of $35 billion. I can't remember the exact figure, Mr. Leon, but I believe that the direct labor cost for the auto companies is only 5 or 6% of their total cost.
Okay. Oh,
so
wow.
Even if you increase that cost by a lot,
sure,
it's still not...
It's not $35 billion.
No, not close.
Now, from what has been reported, that this tiered system based upon part-time workers versus full-time workers, it's been reported that it pits, or at least it creates a very unhealthy work environment between the part-time workers and the full-time workers. The full-time workers kind of look at the part-time workers with the side eye as though you're working harder trying to take my job. And the part-time workers are looking at the full-time workers saying, no, you're keeping us down, just trying to prevent us from moving into the full-time category. Are the tensions that are being reported, are they real, or is that just more fiction to make the story appealing?
Very good question. First, one correction. It's not part-time and full-time. They're all full-time.
Okay.
Some are called temporary, although they're not temporary. They come in every day of the week and stay for years. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed several that had worked there 3 years, 3.5 years. And I think the dynamic that you described, there could be some of that, but I think that is exaggerated. And what's just been really impressive to me in talking to people on the picket line is the degree to which they are saying, no, we want to take care of each other. And I'm trying to think. I don't think any of the workers that I interviewed were actually temporary themselves, so-called permatemps, mm-hmm. but they were all speaking up for the permatemps. They were saying, we don't want to see this kind of inequality persist. And again, like I said before, it's not only that there are these 7% making half the wage of the others. There's also all sorts of other gradations. One set of workers gets a pension, the other set doesn't. Some have better health care than others. So they are saying, let's make everybody equal. We're all doing the same work, which is true. And there was a wonderful sign at the picket line the other day. It said, everyone tier one, everybody in, everybody mm-hmm. equal. And that seems like a very American sort of demand to me.
Now, as I understand it, the strike has already forced General Motors to shut down two Canadian factories that make engines. They also make some of the, I think, older pickups. And it's also feared that if this continues much longer, that some of the Mexico and other Canadian factories that make engines and transmissions will also be affected.
That could definitely happen. At least in Canada, I think those workers would be eligible for unemployment insurance. But, you know, the Canadian workers are unionized, too. They understand the importance of this. They had a month-long strike a year or two ago at one of their important plants to try to keep GM from moving work out of the country. They're a pretty decent, strong union there. So, yes, this is one of the side effects of strikes is that other people are affected as well. And frankly, if I were the auto workers union, what I would be doing is trying to enlist all those people, get them out to the picket lines as well, get them, you know, going on talk shows like this one, agitating to support their brothers and sisters at GM.
Now, it's also important, I think, for people to understand there's a real significant ripple effect. And a lot of times when people start talking about strikes, particularly when they start talking about strikes in the auto industry, they just tend to think about the particular company or the particular plant. They think about General Motors or they think about Ford. But there are a lot of smaller companies that support the large auto manufacturer. There are parts suppliers in all over the Midwest, in Ohio and in Pennsylvania, that make parts for these automobiles. So when the folks in Detroit go on strike at the major plant, or when the folks in Canada go on strike, a lot of these smaller companies feel the impact as well.
Absolutely. And the auto industry is one of the core industries of our country still. You know, yes, tech is very big, but we still do a lot of manufacturing here. And those ripple effects are very real. And not just those, it's all the companies that depend on the purchasing power of auto workers, which is not what it used to be, but it's still important. I mean, all the businesses that surround a plant that sell to those workers, all the people that might sell, you know, back to school clothes for their kids, or, you know, the grocery stores, everything that depends on auto workers' wages. And as you say, the supplier plant's wages, they're going to be affected as well.
The restaurant across the street and the food truck on the corner. All of the auto industry supports a huge element of this economy. Now, do you have any insight into where the government is, where the Trump administration is in this conversation, in this negotiation between General Motors and the United Auto Workers? Because with the president running on bringing manufacturing jobs back, with the president running as a candidate on pressuring companies to bring the jobs back. Any insight into where the administration is on this issue right now?
They haven't said very much. And of course, Trump is caught up in his latest scandal involving the Ukraine right now. He may have other things on his mind, but, you know, he ran on positioning himself as an anti-established candidate, the candidate of the working people. And I think that's been just so thoroughly shown to be untrue over the course of his presidency, when he gave the huge tax breaks to the rich and very little to working people. That was just, you know, one of the many ways that he's shown which side he's always come from. He managed to fool a lot of people last time. I think he'll be able to fool a lot fewer people this time. Maybe you're aware. I'm not aware of any statement that he's even made. Maybe
no, that's why, that's why I was asking you, because I haven't heard anyone from the administration, whether it be on the Sunday talk shows or a direct statement coming from the president himself. I have not heard anything, which is why I was posing the question to you.
No, I haven't heard of one either. And that's, you know, pretty surprising for such a big and important strike. I mean, maybe the reason he doesn't say anything is that he knows there's nothing he can do. I mean, General Motors is not going to pay attention to him, and the auto workers are not going to pay attention to him either.
This is the first national strike by the United Auto Workers since 2007. They seem to have, to the point that you made early on in the conversation, they seem to have really played ball as best they could play ball, particularly during the recession and while General Motors was trying to dig itself out of bankruptcy. How is this playing out in terms of public perception?
Well, there's a lot of people feel like the auto workers gave up a whole lot, and now it's time for them to get some of that back. One of the slogans that I've seen is GM got bailed out, we got sold out. So GM, as you said, making $35 billion worth of profits, and workers in their plants making $15 an hour with no job security. So the auto workers are saying, you know, we did more than our share. Isn't it time that we should share in some of the prosperity that we helped build? Because, you know, of course, they couldn't have done any of this without the workers. They're the ones who actually build the products that are sold that made all those profits.
One of the other issues that I understand is being debated and is a point of contention is the formula for profit sharing. And the union wants to improve the formula for profit sharing. I think the workers currently get $1,000 for every billion that the company makes before taxes. And since you said they're not paying any taxes, that's a pretty good number. This year, the workers, I think, got a check for $10,750, and last year they got a check for $11,500.
That's pretty good. Not too many people would sneeze at that amount of profit sharing.
But again, the union wants to improve that formula.
Yes, and I hope that what they're also saying is that all workers should improve and should participate in the profit sharing, not just the ones that are considered the ones who are not
permanent versus temporary.
Yeah. And I have to say that, you know, profit sharing looks good for companies in a year of low profits. It doesn't, you know, obviously it doesn't look as good. And I think the workers would be better served if they would go after actual wage increases, which are for certain. And they know they will get that because it's in the contract, rather than profit sharing, which is uncertain. And also it ties you to your company rather than tying you to your fellow workers in the other companies.
With the UAW contract as opposed to being tied specifically to General Motors.
Yes, and so we have a situation now where it used to be, back when I was an auto worker a long time ago, everybody made the same pay. And now with the advent of profit sharing and other changes that have come about, you don't necessarily make the same if you work at Ford or you work at Chrysler or you work at GM. So this has led to more of that inequality among workers who are doing essentially the same work.
Final question for you, this relates to healthcare. As I have read, healthcare for domestic striking workers is not being paid for by the company, and the union is now picking up the healthcare for those striking domestic workers. How long do you think the union can hold the line here?
Oh, that's a good question, and I do not have the math on that. The strike fund is $750 million, so that's pretty big, but it can go down fast if you're paying out $250 a week to almost 50,000 people. And, of course, COBRA, which is the way that they're, you know, going to fund the health care, or partial, they aren't going to fund everything that they got, is very expensive. If you've ever been on COBRA, you know that.
Yes.
So, again, I have not done the math, and I don't know the exact amount of their COBRA payments, but it's a little bit of a dicey situation.
Again, so you've been on the line. You've been speaking to striking workers. How dug in are they?
That's a good question, because I have not been out yet on the second week. I was only there on the first week, and there was still a lot of, you know, exuberance, determination. I would expect that to be continuing. Probably the lower paid workers are getting a little bit more scared, even though we hope that this strike is for them. They're the ones who have not been able to save any money, I would predict. So I would suspect that the trepidation is going to grow as the strike lengthens. On the other hand, they were very annoyed, very angered by General Motors cutting off their health care and took that as a slap in the face. So I would not underestimate the staying power and stick-to-itiveness of people who feel that they've been treated unjustly.
The final question, does General Motors have any options replacing strikers? It makes me, every time I hear about an auto strike, I go back to the Ford strike, where the Ford Auto Company, was it back in the 20s or 30s, brought up workers from the South, and the Pinkertons came and beat all these people who were trying to cross the lines. And so what options does GM have?
Well, that would really be the nuclear option. The auto companies haven't tried to do that in the past, although, as you say, they have not had strikes recently. It is legal for them to bring in replacement workers, scabs, even permanent replacement workers, because of the labor laws we have in this country, which favor the employer. But I predict if they would try to do that, which would be seen as, it would just be seen as throwing down the gauntlet. And I predict that the picket lines would swell, that people would come who don't even work in those plants to help them try to block the gates to keep any scabs from going in. That would be a battle royal. That would be a confrontation.
Jane Slaughter, thank you so much. You cover the auto industry for Labor Notes. Greatly appreciate your time today and your insight. Hopefully this won't drag on much longer, but if it does, we'll be sure to have you back.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, the trial begins for a former Dallas cop who fatally shot her neighbor. Opening statements were set to begin today in the murder trial of a white Dallas police officer who fatally shot her black neighbor in his own apartment. A shooting, the officer has said, happened after she entered her neighbor's apartment by mistake. Amber Geiger, 31, is on trial for last year's fatal shooting of 26-year-old Botham Jean, who she said she mistook for an intruder in her own home. Geiger was off duty, I believe finishing a second shift, still in uniform when she shot Jean. She told investigators that after a 15-hour shift, she parked on the fourth floor of her apartment's complex garage rather than the third floor where she lived, and found the apartment's door ajar. How do we make our way through this one? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's the lead attorney and founder of the Law Office of John L. Burris. He is primarily known for his work in the area of civil rights with an emphasis on police misconduct and excessive force cases. As always, John Burris, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you. I will say this is an interesting twist to all of this. I mean, you have a young man that's dead who hadn't really done anything, didn't justify any conduct that would cause his death. And it seems to me he clearly was certainly a mistake that it looked like on his face. It doesn't appear to be any evidence that she had any prior relationship with him to suggest that she wanted to kill him. The real question here is not one of who did it. The question is, what is it? Is it a murder case where there's an intent to kill, premeditation, or reckless disregard for human life, which is second degree? Or is it some lesser offense? A lesser offense would be manslaughter of some kind, involuntary manslaughter, voluntary manslaughter, or just criminal negligence. Having been involved in cases as a criminal defense lawyer and as a prosecutor, I can tell you that this is the kind of case that a jury will struggle with as it relates to whether it's murder or not. And that will be a function of her conduct, her what was going on with her, and would a reasonable person in that position could have made that mistake. And if they think that's true, they could find her not guilty. On the other hand, they could say, well, it wasn't reasonable for that to occur, and they could then find her guilty of a lesser offense, such as manslaughter. If I had to guess here, I would say it's more like manslaughter than it is murder. But, that's something for a jury to decide, because the young man who killed was such a decent young person. I mean, he was an accountant working at a firm, was very religious. And a jury could say, from a biased point of view, that whoever killed the man in which this boy was killed shouldn't have taken place and give the maximum criminal intent to the person who did it. On the other hand, a jury could easily say, and I would not be surprised at this, that would say, look, she made a mistake. It was an unreasonable mistake that she made. She should have known better. She should have been more cautious, and she ultimately killed someone who shouldn't have been killed, and make that a manslaughter. Or they could make it even a negligence cause of action. I don't think she walks out of here freely with no charges, no convictions. There's going to be one of these three. More likely than not, it's going to be a manslaughter. That's based upon recklessness. They could argue that she was reckless in the manner in which not perceiving the events that took place. I understand that the prosecution charged murder, but that's typical prosecution effort. Charge the maximum punishment one that you can get, with the idea of thinking that if you get a lesser included offense, at least you can go down. As opposed to starting down, then there's no place to go. So that seems to be the strategy, as I would see it, in a case like this.
The answer to these questions may be some of the things that you've just said. These are two things that come to mind. One, she's off duty, still in uniform. So, and she is in her own mind, in her own home.
Mm-hmm.
Does the fact that she's a police officer matter in this particular fact pattern?
That's an interesting question. The fact that she's in uniform doesn't matter to me, and I don't think will matter to a jury. The point of the matter is she is off duty.
Mm-hmm.
She's on her way home. I mean, that's the more operative fact. The question is, when she got home, was it reasonable for her to do what she did, or is it just a mistake that people make? I mean, I certainly have known people that go to the wrong apartment. Hell, I did that when I lived in Chicago. You go to the wrong place, and you think that's your place because you're in an apartment building, and you found that you're at the wrong place. Well, that could lead to different kind of consequences for you, but my feeling on it, just looking at it, that it doesn't matter that she was in uniform. It doesn't matter that she was a cop, as long as she had a right to carry the gun. And any person could have the right to carry the gun. And so her perceptions were that she was at her place. And by being at her place, the perception was that her door was open, which then suggests to her that somebody might have been in her place, and therefore you take precautionary measures, as any person would. So the fact is that she's entitled to all the sort of defenses that an ordinary citizen would be entitled to if they were confronted with the same and similar circumstances, because the criminal law applies to them. Generally, when police kill someone, they have a higher burden, a higher standard for them, which means that when they kill someone in the course of their duties, the police are not likely to be found as guilty. as they might be in a circumstance like this, where it's clear that there was no prior relationship and that you really were acting in a negligent manner, if you will, and so therefore you don't get the benefit of being a police officer under these circumstances. Maybe there's some issue given to the fact that you were coming off duty and you might have been a little tired, but I don't think that will get you from a first-degree murder case probably down to a manslaughter.
I don't want to do a whole lot of injecting of things here, but there are just two things that come to mind. One, it's been reported that Mr. Jean had a large red welcome floor mat or doormat in front of his door that she did not have.
Right.
So as you're walking down the hall in whatever delirious, overworked condition your mind might be in, when you get to that doormat, to me, signal number one. Two, they say the door was ajar. So now, if I'm a average citizen, door ajar, I'm going to step back because obviously I didn't leave my front door open. Somebody must be in my apartment. Let me call the police. But she's the police. So she draws her weapon. She leans into the door. But here's the other part. The apartment is not a sterile environment. There must be different furniture in his apartment than her apartment. There must be different things on the walls. So at what point does she come to realize, I must be tripping or this is not my place?
Well, apparently she didn't. And that's the part that will cause problems for her. I mean, the defense, the prosecution shows, just that you made the point, that the house is totally different. The furniture is different. The welcome mat is different. The paintings on the walls are different. Why don't you see any of that when you get there? Or do you have what they call blinders on, that your mind is locked in on a person who may be in the place that you're not think they should be, and therefore you don't perceive the other events that are there? That, to me, goes to the whole question of her mental state. And, you know, if you want to give her the benefit of the doubt that it was a mistake, which we evidence suggests, well, then that certainly can get you down from murder to manslaughter. Mm-hmm. But she cannot walk. I mean, that would be a travesty for her to walk, and largely because of the very things that you have said, that she was not observant in a way that a reasonable person should have been observant.
Let alone a
police
officer.
I mean, you go there and there's a welcome sign in front, and you know you don't have it. You either are drunk, you're delirious.
Thank you.
Or you still fascinated by the love conversation you're having, but you're not seeing things. Well, you don't get the benefit of the doubt of those. Okay, you just don't get the benefit of things you did not see and a reasonable person would have seen. That causes your mental state to work backwards and puts you into a reckless disregard for human life, which could get you a second-degree murder. So, you know, she's in a difficult situation, but I think she's betting on the fact that the jurors might think that because it was a mistake, that she should not be held responsible at all, because you can be held not responsible for a mistake. On the other hand, if one like this, you know, that a reasonable person should have done it, you could have had a good faith belief, but unreasonable, then that's manslaughter. That's a classic case of manslaughter. And in Dallas, they call it recklessness. Well, it's reckless in this case, in the sense that she goes into somebody else's house and doesn't see all the clues that are there that will suggest to you, this is not my place. And she should have backed up. And she did have alternatives. So, you know, there are a lot of moving parts here, but it's not the traditional police shooting case of a black person, unarmed black person. This is, you know, more of a domestic situation that, you know, in the neighborhood. It just so happens it's a cop and a black man.
One of the things I haven't heard anybody discuss, I haven't read, and was whether or not she identified herself before she fired.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I didn't hear that, and that's not listed in any way.
Okay.
And probably should have, given that she's the police. She could have easily have said, police, you know, come out of here. If somebody's here, come out and identify yourself. On the other hand, it seems to me she didn't give anybody a chance like that. She walked in.
Well, that's my
around,
point.
Had her gun pointed. As soon as she saw this man, she shot him.
Well, that's my point, because had she taken, and this gets to another point that I've made with you a number of times that we've had these conversations. Had she taken another moment or second to identify herself, that then might have peripheral vision and other things might have, because I'm imagining in that situation, your eyes are scanning the scene. You're going, wait a minute, where am I? And, you know, hold it, police, just in that split second.
She could have given him a warning, and he might have yelled out,
"Hey, lady, what are you doing?"
Yeah, this is my place. Words to that effect. You know, what's up? Any nothing thing that would give some indication that he wasn't an intruder, an unlawful intruder, that he wants to know what's up, too. She does have the gun. And until she sees someone with a gun or a weapon, she's in a superior position. And that's the part. These are the kind of factors that are going to hurt her because she had options. And, you know, that's why I can't see her getting anything less than a manslaughter here, because if the case is presented properly, she would have had a lot of different options to cause this not to happen. And not only because of her observations, but because of her verbal skills. Part of what police officers have is their verbalness, their verbal skills to let people know this is the police, and if you don't stop, this is what can happen to you. But apparently she didn't give him that kind of chance, because even when he walked out from wherever he was not armed. So he's startled. And that means she's startled. And if she is trained not to be startled that way, she should always have yourself in a position of cover so you can react to something that's in front of you. So good police tactics she did not follow. Well, that also goes to recklessness and may even go, that will cause her not to be held in good stead by the jury. I mean, from what I can see, a jury could easily find her guilty of manslaughter, but they can also find her guilty of murder, but not as likely.
That also gets us back to one of the standard conversations that we've had is police putting themselves in harm's way and then trying to shoot themselves out of it because they don't follow procedure and protocol, which takes me to this question. She'll probably claim, if she hasn't already, self-defense based on the erroneous belief that she was in her own apartment. Can you claim self-defense when the circumstance that you are defending is erroneous and of your own creation? Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense, and it's something that could be said. I mean, she's basically saying, I thought I was in my place. That means that I'm in somebody else is in my place, and there's a castle rule that basically says you have a right to use self-defense, defend your own property. That's certainly a position that she could argue, but all the other factors come into play as well. Whether or not that was reasonable, because the ultimate question is, was it reasonable for her to have that position? And the question there is, what are all the other things that a reasonable person would have seen that would have been clues to suggest, hey, you know what, this may not be my place. And so that becomes a factor to those are facts to consider that mitigate against this notion that I believed I was in my own house, because you can believe that and say it, but the question is, was that reasonable or not? And if it's not reasonable, then because all these other factors would have suggested you, if you had been observant, that you're not in your own house. And that even if you were in your own house, you still got to give the person, you should give the person an opportunity to identify themselves or to find out if that person is armed or not. So, yeah, she can make that argument, but I don't think that's a viable argument in light of all the other factors that are there that should have put her on notice that she was not in her own place. And, you know, what a jury will do, who knows, but I just don't believe, I would hope that a jury would not let her just walk away would because a white female damsel in distress. I hope that isn't the argument that she runs out. There is a black judge, female judge there, so I assume she's going to keep him straight and honest on these issues.
And one final point that just came to mind as you were talking about this, she parked on the fourth floor when she usually on the third floor. I'm thinking about how much time elapsed from when she got out of her car on the wrong floor, which means she's not seeing any of the usual cars, any of the usual things that she's used to seeing on the third floor. She goes through the fourth floor door, which may very well, and I have to score because I don't know, underscore, that it has some kind of different designation on it than the third floor door. I don't know how far down the hallway she has to walk from the garage door to her door, but there are so many indicators and signs before she gets to her door that, lady, you're in the wrong place.
Right. All that's true. That's just true. Now, she could say, I was too out of it. I was too thinking about something else. I was not. And that all may be true. Obviously, it's true to some extent. But that's not a defense.
Got it.
It's just not a defense. It may be all true. You know, you park your car on the wrong floor often, and people do, and you can't figure out where it was. You try to remember the clues, but maybe you can't. And so you keep walking until you ultimately find it. It doesn't appear that she was that way. She just got out of her car. She's on the wrong floor. She doesn't make a notice of it, and then walks on to the building to the same number but on a different floor. These are all factors that a jury will have to consider. It's up to the prosecution, though, to make these significant points to show that she may have had good faith, but it was all unreasonable. And if she had been more reasonable, she would have known she's in the wrong place, and this young man would not have been killed, and who's dead now. And that's the tragedy of all this. So he has to keep the story on the boy, on the young man, too, so that everybody gets that this is a young man who's dead, who should not be dead.
John Burris, as always, sir, thank you for your time. Appreciate your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Absolutely. Always good to be with you. Take care, my friend.
Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.